This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Rose Sherman Williams has seen the ugliest side of humanity. As a Jewish girl in Nazi-occupied Poland, she experienced the raw cruelty and evil of the German troops. She managed to survive concentration camps, and then she experienced the power of forgiveness. We're joined by Rose this afternoon. At 90 years old, she is the oldest Holocaust survivor in San Antonio. Also here is Marion Sokol. She's the director of the Children's Bereavement Center of South Texas. Email us at thesource@tpr.org. Tweet us at @tprsource. Rose, thank you so much for coming up here. Welcome to The Source. It's great to have you here this afternoon.
You're welcome, sir.
Tell me about... You're 12 years old, you're growing up in Poland, and suddenly your life is
turned around.
Yes. What happened?
Well, and I had quite a large family. My immediate family consists of my father, who in 1939 was in his early 40s, or rather 42. My whole family consisted close to about 60 people, which they're all gone now. On September the 3rd, Germany invaded Poland and my city of Radom. Within a very, very short time, our lives turned around completely. Daily, the Germans would come out with posters, and the first on the agenda was no Jewish child could get a public education. All schooling was prohibited. Next, they came out, you had to wear an armband with a Jewish star. They went to City Hall, got the name of all the Jewish people and their addresses, and they came out with a new poster. If you have a radio in your possession, to take it to City Hall. Now that they were in the possession of all our names, they would come to your house unexpectedly. If they did find a radio, they either imprisoned you or shoot you right then and there without any questions asked. I had three siblings besides myself. My oldest brother was 17. I was 12 in 1939. My sister was 10. And I had a brother, 10. Unfortunately, they're all gone now. Life was getting harder and harder. In order to purchase a bread, you had to get up at 12 in the evening and stay in line till 6 or 7 in the morning. If you were not recognized as being Jewish, you were able to purchase a bread. If you were recognized, you were pulled out from the line, beaten up, and sometimes shot, believe it or not. After a period of about 10 months of suffering, they came out with a new poster. They were going to build a ghetto. The street where we lived did not belong to the ghetto. And so we got a letter from City Hall in 1 hour to leave our home. Can you imagine if, God forbid, you would have to leave your home in 1 hour that you lived all your life? What would be your most precious thing to take? It was such a difficult situation. Our grandma got to live with us in 1938. She lost her grandpa to pneumonia in those years that we didn't have penicillin like now. And so we lost Grandpa. My father insisted Grandma come to live with us. And so she tried to put 3-4 dresses on us girls. They tried to put 3-4 pants on the little ones. The beauty part was we had some beautiful, wonderful Gentile neighbors who came in asking my father what they could do to help, offering to take us 4 children and hide us out till after the war. My father took a minute to sit down with us, asking would we be willing to stay with our neighbor. And from the little one to the oldest one, we all start crying. We didn't want to be separated from our family. And in such a mood, with the suitcases, backpacks, pillowcases, whatever we could get, we walked towards the ghetto. It's almost impossible for me to describe the misery, the atrocities, the hunger, the sickness so rampant in the ghetto. In the ghetto, they also made smaller type with offices, and the Germans would come daily in asking for a quarter of people to come to work. In the beginning, people voluntarily would go to work for the Germans, because if you had a chance to get out from the ghetto, you had a chance to purchase some food and maybe able to bring it into the ghetto. But after a while, people start hiding out. We were wondering what happened. What we found out was they mistreated the people so badly that they rather go hungry than go out and get some food. My father was very, very religious. Every morning he would get a quarter of people to get in a designated room and pray. One time going home from his prayers, he got caught by the Germans to go to work. We were so scared that something happened to our father, because due to the fact people disappeared, we never heard from them again. And so we were so scared that maybe we might never hear from our father. But our wonderful neighbors continuously every few days would come back to the gates from the ghetto and bringing us some food. As we were standing with our neighbor and our father continuously begging us to tell the wonderful neighbors not to risk their life, because what if the Polish police or the Germans would catch him? They wouldn't ask questions. They might just imprison him or kill him. But to no avail, in spite of it, they would come in. As we were standing with our wonderful neighbors that night, we saw our father walking in through the gates of the ghetto. Oh, my God.
Rose, I'm going to take a quick break, allow you to drink a little bit of water, catch your breath. We're going to come back, hear more of the story of Rose Sherman Williams. She survived the Nazi Holocaust. She's here in San Antonio preaching the power of forgiveness. More of her story when we come back from the break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. You learned about the Holocaust in history. You heard stories about it maybe on TV, but now it's an opportunity to hear the stories directly from a survivor of the Holocaust, Rose Sherman Williams. She's talking about her experience. She was 12 years old when the Nazi Germany, when the soldiers moved into Poland, her hometown, and her life went downhill from there as her family was brutalized, and they were moved into a ghetto, starved, humiliated, beaten multiple times, and it gets worse from there. And Rose, thank you so much again for sharing your stories with us. And so when we went to break, you were telling us about your father, and there he was. He came through the gate.
Yes, thank you. As my father was walking in through the gates, we got to run over to him and noticed his shirt was full of blood. His chin was all torn up. We ran towards him, grabbing, "Daddy, what happened?" He told us he He went over to a soldier asking for some rags. He need to do some cleaning. And Dad had a small beard. And the German pulled at the beard so strongly that he pulled out some meat. And that's where that blood and the disruption in his chin was. We start crying, and he said, let's go back to the home. As we walked in, we tried to help Daddy clean up the chin. We had hardly any medication. It took quite a while for it to heal. But between my brother and my father, they came to a decision, we're going to dig a hole deep enough, about 6 feet down, and they would hide out in that hole and put a barrel of water over it so it wouldn't look like there's a hole, since the Germans kept on coming now into the ghetto every day and going from house to house looking for people to take to work. When it was almost completed, a new poster was left over the whole ghetto that they're going to send some people out from Radom to some working camps. One or two of the people who had left for the transport and that action came back to the ghetto telling us, please, people, be prepared. Don't go like cows to the slaughterhouse. This is no working camps. Those were liquidation camps. You had shower heads that looked like water should come out, but no water would come. Instead, gas would come out. Once the people were gassed, they would put them to the crematorium to burn. We were so gullible. Those two young people tried to go to the synagogues, to public places in the ghetto, to tell the people to be aware, to be prepared, to buy guns, to protect themselves, not to listen to the Germans, because nothing but lies we've been told. But we were so gullible. Some of the people were almost ready to kill those people. They said, how could a cultural country like Germany do such atrocities? But that was the truth, and that was a fact that was happening. After a period of about another 5 months, August the 6th, 1942, when a new poster came out, they were going to completely liquidate the ghetto. We were so uncertain, what should we do? Should we really all go out or leave our two loved ones behind in that hole that has completed already? We finally decided maybe we better all go out, because continuously they've had so many lies that we never knew what was the truth and was a lie. And so on August the 6th, the whole family walked out and we stayed a line of five. Our biggest place was the marketplace. As we were standing, my grandmother looked to the right and saw Germans pulling our children from mother's arms. Mothers not wanting to give up their children, months old, year old. And the Germans would shoot the mother and throw those children on the rocks. When my grandmother saw that, she loosened my arm, my hand, and started running. I started running after her. Grandma, where you going? She said she was going to pick up those children. I said, Grandma, don't you realize what's going on? A German noticed the commotion in our line. In spite that, I tried to push my grandmother back in line. And he came around and asked, what's going on here? I tried to grab his sleeve. said, "Sir, nothing is going on, nothing is going on." When he turned his rifle around with the butt, he hit me really hard. I still have a place that hair never grew back. Blood came out. I fell. And the next thing, I heard a shot. He had shot my grandmother. It had taken me many, many years to find peace and be able to talk about it. My oldest son became sick of leukemia. We had a wonderful, wonderful director at the museum in San Antonio, the Holocaust Museum, I should say. She kept on coming all the time towards me, to my home, begging us, "Rose, we need some Holocaust survivors to speak to our school children. Please consider it." I could never find the peace to be able to do it. But once my son became sick, my family knew I was a Holocaust survivor, but they didn't know my life story. Knowing I'm gonna lose my son, I told him my story. He made me promise that I would tell it to my children and grandchildren one day. I promised them, but it took me almost 20 years to be able to sit down and write down my life story. And I became a speaker for the school children. And I've been doing it for the last almost 10 years, encouraging our young people not to give up, to be strong, to believe in themselves, and how very, very important in education in this day is. Some children are shy. They're scared to ask their parents. But we have such a wonderful, wonderful teachers, counselors, rabbis, priests. There's so much help. The main thing I tell my children, don't be bashful. And the main thing, don't be a bystander. Maybe if we didn't have so many bystanders, maybe what happened did not happen. And this is my prayers, to believe in God, and God would lead them the right way. It helped me quite a bit when I gave up hope and want to go to the crematorium, but God knew better, and he let me out. While still in Poland, I was sent to an ammunition factory and completely separated from my parents, my family, my siblings. But God had left me. He led me to a beautiful person who, she was Polish descendant, but as a young lady, her parents emigrated to Germany. Her name was Elsie, and she was there close to me in that ammunition factory. She was such a help, offering to be my surrogate mother. In each and every way she could, she encouraged me not to give up. But in spite, life was so difficult in Pionki. And so after a short time, we were told that it was almost the end of 1943, the beginning of 1944. We were going to be sent out from Pionki. While there, we were forever so very, very hungry. In spite that we know it's a sin to steal, But some people were able to bribe the sentries and themselves take some alcohol. And I'm sure to my children, I tell them, as young as they are, they should know that in order to make a bomb, we need alcohol. The factory had quite a lot. And some people, when those sentries who had been bribed, one duty, they would help themselves to some. I guess the factory realized lack of alcohol, and usually we were always told when an inspection was due. I was on the 3 to 11 shift one night. We were not told anything about any inspections. When we had 3 sentries to go through, when we went through the first one, we were fine. We went through the second one, we were fine. But when we got to the 3rd one, 3 huge assessments were standing with a whip, beating us, not knowing that some of the people might have some alcohol on them. When the oldest of those 3 Germans realized that people start throwing that alcohol away, they called us all back in and made a new roll of 5s. As we were standing in that roll, he started counting. Every 10th person he would put to the right. The left 11th person, unfortunately, would go to the left. They took out 27 people that night. And next morning, we were told those 27 people are going to be hanged. We were not allowed to look down. We had to stay and look up at those hanged 27 people. No food, no water. Our friend was the night. We would run into the woods and grab some snow to our parched lips. Relieve ourselves. And after that episode, for almost close to 2 days, we were told the Russians again too close and we were going to be sent out. And this time our destination was going to be Auschwitz. We had to walk 18 kilometers to a railroad station on foot. When we got there, they pushed in 80 to 90 people in the wagon that would hold the most, maybe 20 animals. We were so tight in there, we were given 2 pails to relieve ourselves. If you tried to bend down, you were suffocated, impossible. The crowd, we were so crowded in there.
Rose, powerful story. We're going to continue to hear the story of the train ride to Auschwitz, what happened there, an amazing confrontation with Dr. Mengele, and a brush with death. That story, when we come back, we're talking with Rose Sherman Williams, a Holocaust survivor who lives in San Antonio. She preaches the power of resiliency and forgiveness. The Source continues after this. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. With me in the studio, Rose Sherman Williams. She is a 90-year-old Holocaust survivor now living in San Antonio. She is on a mission to tell children about what happened to her when she was their age in Poland and then in Germany, dealing with the Nazi troops and the concentration camps, and how she survived and how she carried on after she was liberated. She's with us this afternoon telling us her story. This is an opportunity to document her story on the radio and keep this recording available for people online as long as we can, for and also hopefully give people a chance to interact with her as well. If you have a question or a comment, we should have a chance to talk to you. So, Rose, you were telling us about the train trip to Auschwitz and how so many people were
crowded,
shoved into the cattle car.
We walked 18 kilometers to the train. When we got there, they pushed in 80 to 90 people into a wagon. They gave us 2 pails to relieve ourselves. Anyone trying to get to those pails was suffocated, not because anybody wanted to, but because we were so crowded. Not only crowded, but even the smell was awful. For 3 days without water, without food. When we finally arrived, our destination was Auschwitz, and the year was almost the beginning of 1944. When they opened the wagons, more than a fourth of the people were dead. They told us we have to leave everything behind, get completely undressed. We didn't have very much, Elsie and I. We had still some pictures from home, some change of clothing, and I had some really warm boots. Our dad would take us 2-3 times through the year to a shoemaker. It wasn't like here where you can go into any department store, buy any size shoe you wanted. In those years, you had to be big to measure everything. And so I tried with all my might to hold on to those boots, but I got such a beating from the couple, and those were people just like us. The only thing, they were a lot meaner sometimes than the Germans, and they were pulled out of my hand and given some horrible Hollandaise shoes, Hollandaise clogs. They were horrible. People who needed a big size would get small. People who need small would get big. And we were pushed into showers. We were so scared that gas might come out, but water did come out. Once we were showered naked in the wintertime, standing, all women's hair was cut, and we were tattooed. All of us were bereft of our names. I was given a number which I still carry on my arm, A1549. And God forbid, if the couple called your name and you didn't hear, you can imagine the beatings we would get. We were pushed in 600 people to a barrack, 7 people to a bunk bed. Through the night, 1 or 2 of the people would fall down. Some made it, some didn't. Every few days, a doctor by the name Mengele would go through our lines with a long stick and monocle in his ear eye and pick people who he felt that they can still work to the right, and people that he felt that are unable, and he was our God over us, to the left. After a while, working in Auschwitz and standing daily, we had to get up at 4:30 in the morning, standing in line for a roll call. The couple would run in and out counting. The count was never the same, due to the fact people who were in the upper bunk beds maybe got sick or passed out or died. And so sometimes we would stay for days on that roll call. When we finally were sent to work, we were sent to carry stones from one place to the other. By me wearing those terrible Hollandaise wooden clogs, my feet got so ulcerated they were too small. And so at the time, I was already 15 years old and should have known better. I grabbed those horrible shoes and threw them away. What a mistake. I grabbed some paper and some rags that I could find till someone that passed away, that I was able to grab their shoes. But for a while, I was walking in the wintertime barefooted. And so my feet got so ulcerated, I stopped to realize I'm still, although at the time 15 years old, but what sin did I commit? Praying to God, to forgive and for what. I never realized that my prayers were heard. I thought they were not. God heard my prayers, and in spite of it, I lost hope. While standing in line, and Dr. Mengele gone through the lines, I made up my mind, not telling Elsie, I'm going to go to the crematorium. And so when he got to me with the stick, trying to push me over to the right, I raised my hand. He said, what's going on? I said, sir, could I please go to the left? He didn't look at my feet or my legs. He looked at my face, and with a stick, he pushed me to the right. God knew he wasn't finished with me yet. He had plans for me to be able to be here right now on the radio and tell people my life story, as well tell to my wonderful school children, and hopefully helping some to be better, to help themselves, not to give up, and to believe in God. After that episode, working in Auschwitz at those stones, somebody was trying to give me a little piece of paper. They did it at such a speed that I could not catch it. The women's kitchens were always, or I should say, all kitchens were always on the women's side. The men would come to grab their food kettles at the women's kitchens and always bring us a bunch of little papers with news. Have you heard from that person, or do you know anything about that person? And somebody again tried to give me a little piece of paper. This time I was able enough to grab it, but didn't realize who in the world it was. It was with such a speed, it was done. Oh my God, when I looked at that little piece of paper, my little sister was in Auschwitz already for about a few months. And how in the world could I get to her to be reunited with her? She was a few blocks away. But Elsie was so instrumental, knowing somebody of influence in my sister's barrack. And on a flushing night in 1944, I was able to be reunited with my sister still in Auschwitz. How can I describe the beauty of that night? Knowing and thinking I'm all alone and have no one, finding my sister gave me the hope, the belief in God, so much stronger, realizing that he kept me. And for that moment to be reunited with my sister and knowing I'm not alone anymore, I have someone to live for, someone who needs me. My younger sister, who was 2 years younger than I, should definitely needed me. And so from then on, we promised each other that night we're never, never going to be separated again. After a very short time, just about a month or two, we were told that the Russians are bombarding really heavily, as well as the United States, and so that we're going to again be sent out from there to Germany. And this time our destination was going to be Hindenburg. They had sent all the young people to the front, and so that they needed us slaves to take place in different factories and in ammunition and radio stations. And so the same process of walking to a railroad station. And when we got to Hindenburg, we had to build our own barracks. There was a German asking for 10 people who spoke German. My dear friend Elsie spoke German, and so she raised her hand. Not realizing why Elsie raised her hand, I did myself. And Elsie, angry, turned around to me "Do you speak German?" And I start crying. And she said, "Knock that nonsense out. Try and get a piece of paper and pen and write down 10 words and memorize it. Maybe if you have 100 words, maybe you'll be able to make some sentences and speak German. I will try and help you."
Learning to speak German as a way to survive the Nazi concentration camps and the Holocaust. We're hearing the story of Rose Sherman Williams. She's a Holocaust survivor, 90-year-old San Antonio resident, the oldest survivor we have here in town, telling us her story. We're going to take one more break, allow her to catch her breath, take a drink of water, and we'll come back with more with Rose. Stay tuned. All right, we're coming back now, and this is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. We're talking about the Holocaust. We have a survivor with us, Rose Sherman Williams, 90 years old, and she is telling us about what she went through. She was just survived Auschwitz, and now she has been moved on to another camp where the survivors or the concentration camp victims are being forced to work again for the German authorities. And Rose, they want you to survive. You're having to fake that you know German.
I learned German in less than 10 days, and I speak four languages besides English. After that, working in the kitchen was like being in paradise, being hungry for such a long time. And so I tried to help the hospital. I didn't have very much, but I helped with the potato or turnip. By helping the hospital, I also tried to help my sister with the potato or turnip or carrot. But somebody must have noticed that I was doing and announced me to my chef. Our chef, once he left our place, never came back. But then one night, as I was picking up those packages, I saw our chef coming towards me, saying to me with those packages in my hand, "What you got?" I said, "Food." My biggest mistake was I should have told the truth. Instead, I said, "Sir, I was going to ask you, but you had left and he knew he didn't. That was my mistake of lying." But I was so flabbergasted and scared, I didn't know what to say. And let me tell you, I have to admit, knowing all those Germans in 4.5 years, he was one maybe who treated us halfway decently. But that night, I don't know whether my lie got to him. He gave me such a beating, he busted my right eardrum. I lost completely hearing in my right ear. I couldn't get no medication. And after the liberation, I could only get some drops to prevent infection. After that episode, we were sent out after a very short time again. And this time, it's almost impossible to describe the atrocities of Bergen-Belsen. No water, lice, mice, no beds, floors. It's almost impossible for any human being how to survive. I asked my question that many a times myself. I haven't found an answer. To walk to Bergen-Belsen is almost indescribable. Once there, thank God, it was just a very short time. It was April 15, 1945, when a big truck drove into our camp, claiming the English, the our liberators, throwing care packages. Unfortunately, the people who grabbed those care packages, 90%, we found out statistically, they didn't make it due to the fact our stomachs were not used to the good food, and so they lost their life already being free. The English immediately told us they're going to dislouse us with a lot of DDT, shower us, give us new clothing, and send us over where the Germans had escaped a few days ago. And so they sure did all that they promised, and then some. Organizations from all over came in, offering my sister to come to the United States with the children transport. When she was asked, she consented, but when she realized when her visa came in that she only can go due to the fact she was 15 years old. I was 17 and Elsie was already in her 40s, and so we couldn't go with her, and so she declined. After a period of a few months, word came out, we found out my brother survived Mauthausen, and he found out that we survived, and so on foot he came to Bergen-Belsen. When I saw my brother, I jumped on top of him, hugging and kissing him, and telling him our sister could have left for the United States and declined. He said, is this the greeting you're giving me? I started crying and said, okay, we're going to go back. Due to the fact that President Truman was president at that time, he gave orders to President Eisenhower, who was a general at the time, and for the displaced persons someplace, and so they got Stuttgart. My brother got a beautiful home, and we all walked back with him. We registered with the American consulate, and we had to go through medical examination. What they found out, I was 87 pounds and could not make it. I was very ill. I was put in the hospital. My brother, they found out, had tuberculosis, and he could never make it to come to the United States. And so they put him in a pension up in the mountains, in a hospital or sanatorium, something like that. After 2 years, they smuggled him out to Israel. Elsie and I were readjusted and we came to the United States in 1950. Through an organization, our destination was supposed to be Seattle, Washington. Unfortunately, my sister was in the pier. I shouldn't say unfortunately, but my sister found out that we arrived, and so she took all responsibility, and we stayed with my sister. I hope what happened to me never happens again. We lost 6 million people, 1.5 million children, 5 million of different denominations. Let's hope it never happens again.
Rose, how do you remember, how do you process the fact that all of this horribleness happened to you, and how do you think about it, in what terms? I mean, we talk about that you preach the power of forgiveness. How is forgiveness part of your story?
Well, we were liberated. I was assigned to some German people to live with. When I start she felt I resented her, and she started telling me her story. She had 2 sons. She lost 1 son at the front. Her 2nd son, she don't even know if he was alive. They did not want to become Nazis, but if they had not, they would have been sent to a concentration camp just like ours, maybe not as difficult as ours was, due to the fact that anyone who did not become a Nazi was deprived of their kid cards, food, clothing. And so she started crying and telling me that story. Right then and there I realized they were also victims, some who did not believe in Hitler's theory, but they were forced to do it due to their own neighbors would tell on them. And so I grabbed the woman, hugged and kissed, and told her, I want you to know that I forgive you, but I can never, never forget. And this is my motto till today. I forgave, but I can never forgive. I forgave, but I can never forget. And this is my life story through till almost in my 20s. And like I said, I hope it never happens again. Thank you so very much. And if there's questions, I'd be more than happy to answer. Thank you.
And so you've seen just how horrible people can be to other people beyond imagination. And you talk about how that people couldn't believe that certain things were possible because they didn't think that a cultured civilization like the Germans could be so horrible, but yet they were. So what do we do with that information that people can be inhumane to other people?
President Eisenhower realized. He called in his whole cabinet. He said, please, people, take as many pictures as you can, because someday there'll be someone and say it never happened. And therefore, we have so many still veterans who have still survived and who had liberated many of the camps and are life witnesses as well. There's still pictures and from survivors who had made it. And so this could not be ever denied.
But there are people who do deny it. They still say it didn't happen or it wasn't as bad as they say it was.
It was a lot worse than we even can tell. The strategies are almost unbelievable that I could tell you. They would just for no reason, if you turned the wrong way, you might have been shot or beaten for no reason whatsoever. But there's so many, many wonderful people in this world, as well as bad. And my motto is try to avoid the bad ones and just stay with the good ones. Whether this is what I believe, other people might believe in something else. But denial cannot be done. There was also one who wrote a book trying to deny, and he was taken to court in England, and the case was won because it was a fact. That's what really happened.
Rose Sherman Williams, she has seen the ugliest side of humanity because she was there when the Nazis marched into Poland as a 12-year-old girl. She experienced the raw cruelty and the evil of the troops and the institutions that were trying to exterminate the Jewish people. Rose, thank you so much. I'm so thankful that you were here this afternoon telling us your story.
I thank you very, very much.
We're ending the show now. We're out of time, but it was great to have you here.
Thank you.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thank you so much for tuning us in.